You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Secretary of Homeland Security and former South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem returned to the state last week. She received an honorary degree from Dakota State University and served as their commencement speaker. The move by the university sparked protests in the city of Madison. John Hunter is publisher emeritus of the Madison Daily Leader, and he's a member of the South Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame. Michael Card is professor emeritus of political science at the University of South Dakota. They join me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls.
Noem was invited to be the commencement speaker when she was still governor. So this would have been sometime before January or whenever her resignation took place. So over the years, Governor Noem and the legislature and the Board of Regents and many others have been very supportive of Dakota State University's growth in cyber operations, cyber defense, and others. She proposed in her state of the budget address or in the annual budget address allocations or appropriations, proposed appropriations for each of those areas, for specifically for areas for faculty recruitment, student recruitment, most recently a quantum computing partnership with South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. So Dakota, those who are in charge of those sorts of invitations thought that would be a good way to honor her. Since then, the world changed, and she resigned that position and became Secretary of Homeland Security, at which she implemented some policies of the new administration, some of them which were unpopular with people at Dakota State University. Among them was the deportation of students, international students, especially at least allegedly those who were perfectly qualified to be here. There was a high-profile case out in, I believe it was Mines, wasn't it, Mike?
School of Mines.
Where a student was set for deportation, ended up being able to stay. But certainly international students were concerned with this. And a big part of the student senate had his international students. There are a lot of international students at Dakota State. I can't remember the numbers exactly, but I think maybe 5 out of 8 of the senators are from other countries. So some of them abstained from a vote for that. So the remaining ones were, I think it was less than a quorum taken on that. So the, those students ultimately were opposed by not passing something. Faculty also had concerns, I think, on behalf of their students. Some faculty, of course, are also international people. They've come from other countries and would be here in various states of citizenship and or visas and that sort of thing. So it was, I think, a little bit of an awkward position for Dakota State then, because having issued this invitation, and you don't rescind those typically.
Right.
And I think it was a recognition of the real support that Governor Noem had provided while she was governor. So on the day of the commencement, let's catch up to May 10th then. On the day of the commencement, there were people protesting lined up along Washington Avenue on both sides of the street, lots of signs, so forth, and fairly vocal, very peaceful, very honorable protest. And so that was most of the morning. I think they were there from about 8 o'clock to about 1 o'clock. The commencement took place late morning. So, and that those kind of protests, of course, make local media. So Madison Daily Leader, television stations, other media of different sorts.
Associated Press, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So, and then when it was over, it was over. I mean, I didn't see any residual kinds of things after that, no protests once it had taken place. And I think people were moving on.
Yeah. So this idea, as I was reading the Associated Press story, that people were speaking anonymously, Dr. Card, and they were concerned about being able to speak up because they were afraid of retaliation from the administration. The university administration, then also, you know, the federal government, they were concerned about things. This is, seems to me to always be a delicate balance in higher education with people wanting to speak up, but then they're going to get jobs in the future and they're also balancing their future. Are there any insights that you take from how this unfolded at Dakota State that you think particularly went well, like this is how it's supposed to happen? People, you know, there's a vote, the administration makes a decision, there's a protest, we move on. or areas that you think perhaps maybe need to be revisited?
Well, I don't know that those necessarily need to be revisited, although I would add to this that it's the Secretary of Homeland Security is also in a position to perhaps funnel more money to Dakota State University for security issues. There are also students who are likely to be afraid of speaking up for anything. They just don't want to speak up. They often come up to the front of the class after it's over and ask what would have been a great question to take off. But that's the sort of thing that happens. You know, it's the university president is a duty provided to them by their governing board in almost all institutions. There's usually a commencement committee that determines who are some good candidates. They may make a recommendation or list a slate of candidates to the executive officer, the president of the university, who then checks it out with the governing board and sees if it's okay. The idea of protests, that there is free speech as long as it's not threatening to an individual, that's America, that they didn't try to deliberately disrupt the commencement is not cancel culture. That seems to be avoided. It allowed people to speak their minds and to state their views and perspectives. Yeah. From what I've read and reported, I don't live in Madison, so I didn't get to see this, but it seems that it went about as well as it could go.
Yeah. And then, John, several days later, there is a series of arrests, 8 arrests at 2 different manufacturing facilities in Madison. I'm not finding anything that says those were related. Are you?
No, they are. I'm quite certain they are unrelated. I can't see how the other agencies besides ICE knew about this thing sometime in advance so that they could prepare for this possibility. So I don't think it would be related at all to that.
So tell me what that was like with the coverage locally about the ICE workforce. I'm going to try and think of what they're called. According to information or allegations received by ICE, they did a workforce enforcement action, in quotations.
I'm glad you remembered, because I didn't
remember. I didn't remember. I wrote it down. I was going to call it a raid, but it was not a raid, according to ICE. It was a worksite enforcement action, so we'll use their language.
Well, there were 2 Madison businesses that were involved in this, 3 persons from one and 5 from the other. They were taken by ICE because they were not documented properly.
Allegedly.
Now, yep. Allegedly. Yep. Thank you. Part of the trick is that the action actually is partly against the employer. Remember, employers have responsibility to make sure that the people they employ are, check all these boxes. And so I've done that as a small business owner, and everybody, you have to have everybody in there. Part of the trick is that businesses, and again, of all sizes, don't have the capacity to recognize forgeries or false documents. And I'm pretty certain that's what happens here. They are actually available on the internet. You can get false documents to do that. So it's very unfortunate that the businesses are caught in this situation where they asked for the right documents, they got the right documents, and they brought them forward. So, but the people were taken. I think the businesses are in some senses saddened because these are your employees. You treat them well, and they have co-workers and friends and so on. You hired them for a reason. They're doing a job. So now you're missing 5 or 3 people from your operation. Yeah. So it's, on the other hand, you want people to obey the law, and we've set up laws. And so it is awkward for the businesses. I don't know. I didn't know any of the persons involved. I would have no way of knowing their names or anything. So
we haven't heard any fallout in the community from the school or the
well, I
family,
think,
friends, relatives, legal aspects of how they're being treated, or that's not like on the street.
No, that's
at
a great question.
At the local coffee shop. Yeah.
That's a great question, though, and I think there is some discussion of that. And again, you typically would have children in school and people working with, there are a lot of people in every, I would guess the top 50 sized towns in South Dakota would have someone working with people who speak other languages in some sort of English as a second language kind of programs. And there certainly is that in Madison. And so I would guess that they probably were working with some of the detainees and were and maybe had, you know, worked with their children in school and so forth. So I think there is a sense of losing a little something there. Now,
we don't know if they were parents.
We don't know.
Okay, just to be clear.
At least I don't.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm making the assumption that out of 8 people who were working at a manufacturing plant, there might have been children, but I do not know
right.
that. Yeah.
And there may be other people who are in that same position who weren't detained in this particular one. We know we know these 8 were taken. But so I think there it just feels like there's this little gap where we had some people and they're not here anymore. I don't know, but people want to obey the law. And they recognize there are rules set up for these kind of things. So I don't think anyone's saying this is, you know, illegal to do this or whatever. Right. It just feels
to go through their court process too. So we don't know how this resolves yet.
But, we don't.
But, yeah, but it has an impact on a community.
It does. Even a small number of people in a, you know, among a population, I just think it's felt.
And you recently talked to the Madison Chief of Police, which you're going to write about in the future, and they were not part of this enforcement action, but they were listed among the cooperating agencies, but the city police don't necessarily enforce federal law.
I always appreciate the insight when you get to talk to a chief of police or a sheriff, the things that go on beyond what I normally know. And they were contacted by ICE earlier, as were other agencies. They were something they called perimeter control or something like this. So I think they're kind of on the outside in case something happens. But there's so much cooperation among agencies in all sorts of things now. And I became aware of some other ones. We have whether it's controversial or not, I think it's a good thing. We have installed in Madison, the first city in South Dakota to install these cameras that take a picture of license plates and then compare them to databases. There's lots of cameras around. They're not the first to do that, but that somehow is involved in this database matching. And so they can literally, if there's a car that's being pursued in another state, within 12 seconds or something like that of when that is taken, then we can be notified that this car is here. And so there are some, you know, people, criminals or alleged criminals from other jurisdictions who come through Madison that we can be aware of, whether they stop in Madison or they're just on their way through. But what struck me, Lori, I think with that conversation is cooperation with multiple agencies. And you think too, you know, Highway Patrol has jurisdiction in Madison, partly because state highways go through there. The Sheriff's Department covers all of Lake County. Madison Municipal Department covers within the city limits. But then you've got ICE and you've got, you know, whatever else. So, and the communication, I think, has improved a lot among agencies, just in my opinion, at least in Madison it has. We have a new police facility now in Madison, which has a lot of improved capabilities, including things that you often don't think of, whether it's interview rooms, privacy interview rooms, either for victims or possible perpetrators, where you can interview in a comfortable setting. It would be recorded. You can use it. You know, it's not depositions necessarily, but to try to get the facts. I was just very warmly impressed by the progress of both cooperation and technology in today's police work in Madison.
Well, we look forward to reading that column in the Madison
Thursday.
Daily Leader this Thursday. I want to jump over
Can I jump into one part of the earlier story, and that is we human beings tend to think that correlation is causation. We look at the timing of Secretary Noem's appearance in Madison compared to the raid several days later, we may think ipso facto this is related. And it's just not necessarily. It may be, but then you need some evidence that leads that they are linked to each other. Mm-hmm. And we haven't seen any of that in this instance. But it's something that all of us have to watch out for because we hear some correlation, some relationship, but we need some linkage between them before we jump to conclusions.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Speaking of law enforcement and criminal justice, let's talk about the Prison Project Reset. We have a new report. Earlier in the hour, we heard from Lee Strubinger talking about how the report is making lawmakers rethink the sentencing landscape, which I think is the new phrase you're going to be hearing a lot, and the cost of incarceration. Mike, let's start with you. When you see some of the headlines or if you've had a chance to look at the report at all, And you see the cost of incarcerating people with our current set of state laws. Do we need a big change? Because we're going to have to build more prisons, not just because our population is increasing, but because of how we are reliably tough on crime, let's be honest.
Well, we are. And South Dakota tends to incarcerate more individuals than most other states, if not all other states. And the comparison between ourselves and North Dakota, which has generally the same makeup of the population, in terms of there's both areas that we might say are a little more wild than meets the common standard for civil conduct. You know, there's dealing with the Bakken Formation, and in many cases we're dealing with an increasing size of Sioux Falls, which is going to attract more people, and the area around Sturgis. We know that there are more drug crimes during the rally. But it's also the case that we still incarcerate almost twice as many more people than North Dakota does. Okay. And we've also in the legislature this past year, I believe this year, we eliminated presumptive probation. And so we want people to serve full sentences. And that is, as if this is what the law says that you would serve, we want to limit judges' discretion to make sure that people are receiving the appropriate punishment. It seems that that's what's going on. Well, that's really going to change because now we need to incarcerate those people rather than release them. The more people we incarcerate, the more difficult it is to conduct programs that can deal with drug treatments and other sorts of matters that might lead people to commit crimes. And as we reduce the number that are getting released on the back end, our population is just bound to go up. And I think it was Lieutenant Governor Van Huysen who noted we have to look at how these things are related to one another. And I think most of us have known that. And but he just gave it words. And that's not just, he gave it words. Yeah. And so we've got a potential problem facing us that we're going to have to double the prison size by 2030 or thereabouts, which is may seem like... seemed to me like a long time ago, and then I remembered, oh, that's only 5 years.
Yeah,
so
that's right around the corner. Yeah. And we've been saving for a while. It's hard to get the project done. And, John, a reality check, perhaps, for lawmakers, for South Dakotans, about the cost of incarceration, do you think?
I think I'm hoping lawmakers take one step away from that and said, look, let's try to figure out a way, if we incarcerate people, that we can return them back to society. This is... it's the whole Department of Corrections kind of thing that is really, in sometimes it is the Department of Punishment. And so that's part of what we do. But I think I would be concerned, another conversation with our police chief in Madison, he was talking about meth crimes, which are still exist and exist all over South Dakota, where he talked about, you know, the number of months to get your body clean from that. He right. said 9 months. I don't know if that's true or not. Then there's probably another, maybe double that to do, get your mind back. In that. And so if we have some sort of release after 6 weeks or 8 weeks or something like this for a meth crime, then it's just going to repeat that cycle. So mm-hmm. I think that takes all sorts of, there might be some crimes that, you know, could be rehabilitated very quickly, and some maybe that take a very long time, some maybe never. But I do think that lawmakers have to look beyond just the one question. Are you going to put them in prison or are they not going to go to prison? That's too simple. Right. It's much more complicated. And I think the new prison facility and new programming can help control that number without saying, look, let's just not jail people.
Yeah. And it's about a lot more than does it go here or does it go here?
Right.
There's a lot happening, yeah.
And we've also got jails as opposed to prisons, jails who are much shorter-term methods of incarceration. And I think another point is we do need to recognize that there are some people that need to be kept away from society for a period of time. But almost everybody gets out eventually. Mm. So what are they prepared for as they leave? And if we don't have the appropriate facilities, as John noted, to give these people another life, then they will repeat the same life when they're outside the walls of the prison or jail, and we're in trouble again.
I think there's one more thing to that, and that is find where rehabilitation is working, where recidivism is low. And it doesn't have to be elsewhere in the United States. It can be in another country or whatever. And there are certainly cultural things to that. But let's find where we've had successes in this area and open ourselves up to those ideas. Not say, well, this is the way we did it in 1880 when we built our current prison. Here's the way. here's a better, maybe a better way to do that. So I'm hoping lawmakers are open to that idea too. Now, a 3-month task force or whatever this is probably doesn't have time to do that. But let's open ourselves to great ideas that are occurring elsewhere and take advantage of those.
Yeah, I'm sure we can do better than 1880, South Dakota. I hope.
150 years is a long time for a building.
Well, and if we remember, the original idea behind a prison was from the Quakers, at least in the United States, was from the Quakers in Pennsylvania. And it was to isolate you so that you'd think about what you'd done and reflect upon how you can live your life differently. We're a long ways away from that. And that isn't going to be appropriate for all individuals. So we have to have multiple strategies to get to where we want to go. Yeah. When I was working at Miami University, driving from Columbus, I drove past 2 3,000 unit each maximum security prisons. Wow. And yes, I did lock my door as I drove past. One of our graduate students would teach over there. I thought, nah, I'm not ready for that. It just shows what a wimp I really am. No. But they had been built and filled within 5 years. And I think that's something we have to be prepared for, is as we build new facilities to either rehabilitate people, not either, and to prepare them for the next life and to keep them safe from society, safe from them. If we build it, they will fill it. Who's the they? And I think we need to involve the judges in this, and we need to involve local law enforcement, state law enforcement, as well as correctional officials and people living in the society to think, you know, this is a complex problem. It's not going to be solved easily, as John was intimating. And so
we're going to be talking about this for a long time. This is part of, this is one of the things that we talk about, because it is an ongoing problem that we're always going to be grappling with. So if you think that it's going to be a, you know, here's this budget line item and now it's done and we've built the building and it's over, then you're probably not thinking about this the right way.
And that happened in Minnesota. You know, they just had as a budget line item, literally closing the Stillwater prison. And so it turned out it was in budget negotiations. It wasn't in human services or Department of Corrections negotiations or what's best for this. It was a budget line item where they said, we need $50 million. Let's close Stillwater. Whatever, 1,200 people there have to go to other facility. I mean, that was, it just seemed like exactly the wrong way to approach that, is from a line item budget perspective.
Yeah.